Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we'll meet painter Susan Mayberry. We'll update a story we did about America's love affair with the oyster, and just in time for Thanksgiving, naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about Delmarva's wild turkeys. Susan Mayberry is a Queenstown artist with an eclectic set of mediums. She makes her living primarily as a muralist. She also accepts commissions for faux finishes and oil paintings, and she produces fine art crafts. When I spoke to her recently in her studio, she told me about her beginnings as an artist.
I studied at the University of Maryland in College Park and studied art and art history, and I studied African art and just modern art. I studied painting and wood sculpture, mostly, and I'm fascinated by all sorts of processes, I think. But I started working on a big house, a mansion, with a company, and they were renovating it and doing all kinds of wonderful, amazing decorative painting. We spent, you know, months in one room just layering and adding detail, and that was really quite an experience. And there are a lot of places that I've worked that are inspiring to have been in, but that brought me over this direction to the eastern shore, and then I met my husband, moved over here, and have been fascinated by nature and everything that I've discovered after moving here and learned about. My children went to school in Queen Anne's County, and they got involved with a birding program. So we traveled around the shore, down to Cambridge a lot, and then participated in the World Series of Birding in Cape May, New Jersey, which was incredible. So I constantly learning, you know, about nature, about everything in this area, the history, the culture. It's fascinating.
Faux finishes are surfaces painted to look like stone, wood, or other textures. Marble finishes were quite popular for a while. Now Susan says the fashion has shifted, and she finds herself creating metallic finishes like brushed gold or pewter. Each project is an opportunity to meet someone new and learn something.
Generally, the faux finishes I've done, the paint is rolled on and it's taken off in a negative fashion with a, you know, rag or plastic or paper, all sorts of different things that that you can use to manipulate the paint and move again around the wall as quickly as you can. I've done some interesting plaster techniques and Venetian plaster, which is polished. That's very labor intensive. It's a lot of layers. Most of the time people have a good idea of what they're looking for, and I'm able to work with them, and I usually provide sample boards of the idea they've come up with, whether it's a textured wall or, you know, an idea for a mural that they have. And I tend to err to the subtle side of things. But I'll provide them with a drawing and an idea of what it will cost. And it's really fun, and it's wonderful to meet people and go into their homes and make something, you know, new or beautiful, or really make them happy. I do approach things from an intellectual perspective, and then I try to not let that interfere too much with the process and try to let my emotions or this spiritual ideas sort of flow or take over. I would say it's sort of light and ethereal is the way that I like to try to come across, and detailed. I like to layer a lot of sheer layers of color so that it's subtle, and you can't, it just brings about a warmth that you can't necessarily see right off the bat. I will pull up photographs. Yeah, my memory is not always right in tune that I can pull that right out of my head. So I like to have a visual reference, and then I will come up with a drawing and use that to work from. I think in the past I've done things from my imagination. That's something as an artist you always struggle with back and forth, you know. I've tried to do plein air painting outside too, just for my own self.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and we're talking to painter Susan Mayberry. Susan also teaches her crafts.
I've taught children's classes locally, and that was an interesting experience on the Gunston campus. And the kids really enjoyed being outside. That's what we discovered. I also have been teaching some classes at the local arts council. I taught a cloud painting class and paper marbling.
Susan also makes ornaments from blue crab shells left over from steamed crab feasts. These are cleaned, dried, and painted, and then finished with an enamel resin. The paintings are usually of animals and birds. Her clever designs make use of the crab shell points to accentuate feathers or fur. Nature is Susan's biggest influence, and this is evident in the other crafts she makes, particularly sea glass mosaics.
Well, I collected a lot of sea glass locally. My children and I did, and I wanted to find a way to use it, and with my love of nature, I decided to make the designs and the shapes of animals and critters that are around the bay and just have fun with it. And I started to make them in 2007. Our town, Queenstown, had a 300th birthday. So they had a big festival and craft fair. So I started selling them there and I've been making them ever since.
You can see Susan's mosaics at the Sea Glass Show and Workshop, which is underway today and tomorrow at the Chesapeake Bay Environmental Center in Graysonville, Maryland. Visit our website to see a video of this interview and samples of Susan's work. And be sure to visit the Queen Anne's County Arts Council in Centerville to see Susan's crafts at their Heck with the Malls sale coming up on December 3rd. While you're there, be sure to stop in the Commerce Street Creamery for some ice cream and take a stroll through beautifully quaint Centerville, which boasts lovely colonial and Victorian architecture, as well as the oldest courthouse in continuous use in Maryland. Find links and details for this story and other cultural events on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts. It's time for our first break. Stick around. When we come back, we'll hear about the history of a cool weather favorite here on Delmarva, oysters. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and I'm so glad you've joined us today. Oyster season is now underway, and news reports say that many of the oysters harvested so far have been disappointing. However, watermen have hopes that things will improve. Here's an updated story from our archive about the history of this quintessential Delmarva seafood. Charlie Petrocci is an historian and former game warden who lectures about our seafood heritage and has organized a local seafood festival or two. I asked him to tell me the story of America's love affair with the oyster.
So fishing heritage has roots in tourism. I mean, even if you look back, the beginning of tourism on the Eastern Shore started post-Civil War. You know, and a lot of it came out of the misery and loss of the Civil War, or certain things that happened in the late 1860s, early 1870s. Cities became crowded. Alcoholism became a way of life for a lot of people. Tuberculosis was on the rise. And so people wanted out. They wanted to escape. And this is where you saw towns like Atlantic City, New Jersey, Ocean City, Maryland, and so on and so forth, began to give rise to tourism, vacationers, you know, people coming down to spend time on the beaches. And the men who fought in that war, the camaraderie that was established, they began to form hunt clubs to come together as a group, and not so much because of the hunting, the weapons and things like this, but it was a chance for them to get away and be who they were when, say, they had served their time in the Army. And so this was also part of a vacation in tourism development as well. And so, you know, we saw this rise of recreation, which was hunting and fishing as part of people coming out of cities. You know, you see the old photographs of people on the beaches, and whether it's in vacationing in hotels on Wallops Island or Wachaprigg, or certainly up in Ocean City in Fenwick, where you have, you know, folks holding up fish, long stringers of trout, you know, red drum and black drum. Obviously, that was part of their vacation, where things like the beach swimming was not, getting tan lines was not so much of an important issue. So fishing heritage here has its roots that go back, you know, 150 years. And it has developed slowly in the 1920s. You started seeing the rise of sport fishing taking place, the cities growing in population, ethnic groups coming in, again, post-Civil War, and they brought a lot of their desires in culinary areas. And so they were looking for those fish. They enjoyed, say, around the Mediterranean, along the coast of Ireland and Holland and whatever. And so America had great opportunity for seafood development. And so those paralleled as well with tourism and also the rise of culture in America. So fishing in this area, both commercial and sport fishing, I think were important, you know, for cultural development and also economic development.
You're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and Charlie Petrocci is telling us about how the oyster became so popular.
You know, after the Civil War, this tremendous love affair arose, and we could not get enough oysters in this country. And oyster houses opened up everywhere, you know, Chicago and San Francisco and New York. And you saw pictures of miners out in Arizona and the Dakotas, and these rough-honed men with pickaxes and shovels behind them, a mound of oyster shells. Like, how the hell did they get oysters out here? Well, it was the trend, you know, it was a sign of wealth. Status in many cases to eat oysters, but also it was the food of the common man. Just like hot dog stands in New York, you'd belly up to the stand on the street where they're roasting oysters or shucking them raw, and they're a penny a piece or two for a penny, nickel beers. And, you know, we just couldn't satiate the market. And this is part of the demise of the oyster in the beginning. And New York City, for example, had over 1,000 oyster houses. 1,000, man, that's a lot. Today there's only one left. It's called the Oyster House, and it's in Grand Central Station, and it's still there. It's from, I believe, 1886. So, you know, the oysters have been an iconic species product, a seafood product for Americans for a long time.
There are folks who could taste the difference between a Pacific or Olympia oyster from the American West Coast or an East Coast Maine pemmiquid. Charlie says it's all about the water.
I think here in Eastern Shore, our claim to fame is the salt oyster. And that term is derived from the fact that oysters are one of those species that could tolerate huge swings in salinity. So you find oysters along the coastal corridor in the back coastal bay, certainly, with high salinity. But you also find them far up to Chesapeake Bay, Rock Hall and above. So they have evolved to tolerate big swings in salinity. But because, again, the seafood is only as good as the water comes from, also the water imparts flavor as well. So coastal oysters, high salinity, are going to be saltier than oysters, say, coming far up the bay or the Gulf of Mexico during the rainy season. And that will dictate price. That will command a higher price, your saltier oysters. So Chincoteague salts became famous.
That was Charlie Petrocci in a story we did previously on oysters. One aspect of their history in our region that Charlie did not go into was the notorious Oyster Wars. As early as 1719, Delaware and New Jersey set up a leasing system to regulate the oyster beds in the Delaware Bay estuary. In 1830, the states of the Chesapeake region began restricting fishing in their waters to their state residents. But competition was steep, and watermen had trouble acknowledging state lines when they were out on the water. Confrontations on the Chesapeake escalated into violence. In 1868, in order to enforce the law and police the conflicts, the state of Maryland created the Maryland Oyster Navy, which eventually became the Maryland Natural Resources Police. Many notorious incidents of this turbulent period have been recorded. One minor escapade that I found amusing happened on March 4, 1883. The Virginia Fisheries Police heard that the Dancing Molly, a Maryland oyster pirate ship, was hanging out near one of their inlets. With no activity on deck, they thought the captain was ashore and mistakenly thought the ship was an easy target. However, the wife and daughters of the captain actually were on board, and in response to the police gunfire, those expert lady sailors had no trouble getting back to the safety of Maryland waters, much to the surprise of their would-be captors, who actually cheered when they slipped across the state line. Hostilities over oyster territories continued until 1959, when a waterman caught in the act of illegal dredging was shot and killed by a Virginia Fisheries police officer. This shocked all involved into ending the so-called Chesapeake Oyster Wars. Today, the commercial oyster season runs from October 1st through March 31st. The three states in our region regulate where, how many, and what size oysters watermen can harvest. The first month of the season is reserved for people using hand tools like tongs to bring up the shellfish. During November, things open up for the dredging operations. On the Chesapeake side, in Virginia, some watermen feel that there are simply too many licenses issued and too few beds open for them to harvest from. In Maryland, watermen have similar sentiments. According to NOAA statistics, in 1880, there were about 75 million pounds of oysters landed in the Maryland portion of the Chesapeake Bay. In recent years, that number hovers at or below about 400,000. The environmental group, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, refers to the oyster beds as the coral reef of the Chesapeake Bay. As water filters, they are critical to the long-term health of the estuary, and their success as a species is a key indicator in judging the state of that health. Early in the 2000s, the Oyster Recovery Partnership was founded to help restore and grow the Chesapeake oyster fishery. Oyster shell recycling and aquaculture oyster farming projects are now underway around the region. Scientists and volunteers are trying to replant oyster spats to revive old beds. It takes a couple of years for the spats, or juvenile oysters, to mature. Marine fishery scientists carefully monitor their progress and the diseases that could devastate an annual crop. In 2015, President Barack Obama signed Executive Order 13508, an extension of the Clean Water Act of 1972, calling the Chesapeake Bay a national treasure and ordering the restoration of oyster populations in 10 of its tributaries by 2025. Oysters in the Delaware Bay are also being cared for through the efforts of groups like the Delaware Bay Oyster Restoration Task Force. Writer Jonathan Swift is quoted as musing, "He was a bold man that first ate an oyster." In fact, there are many ways to eat oysters: raw, steamed, roasted, fried, or stewed. I enjoy just about all of them, though my favorite is roasted on the grill. Here's hoping that scientists and watermen continue to work together to assure the perpetuation of this species, which is so important to our environment, our economy, and our culture. If you'd like to find out more about this topic, visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/food. We'll have links to information about oysters and their history, as well as a recipe for oyster stuffing. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On November 19, 1861, the New York Times reported that 4,000 troops left Newtown in Worcester County, Maryland, which is now known as Pocomoke City, to suppress rebel insurgents in Accomack, Virginia. And on November 19, 1925, the steamship Lenape, a decommissioned World War I troop transport ship, was burned at sea and scuttled just off the Delaware coast. It's time for a break now. Stay tuned, and when we come back, naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about wild turkeys. Did you know that according to the USDA, 14% of American households did not have a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food for at least part of 2014? Please consider giving generously to your local food bank regularly throughout the year. Visit our website for links for your state, delmarvaalmanac.com/hunger. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about Delmarva's wild turkeys.
No other bird is more synonymous with fall family traditions than the turkey. We learn the basics of turkey identification as kids by tracing outlines of our hands to make Thanksgiving art. Many of you probably have these mini masterpieces hanging on your refrigerator right now. Unless you're a vegetarian, there's a solid chance you'll be dining on a perfectly roasted butterball this Thursday with family and friends. The domestic turkey that graces our Thanksgiving table today is far removed from its wild cousin. The wild turkey is one of only two birds domesticated in the Western Hemisphere. The other is the Muscovy duck. 500 years ago, European explorers shipped turkeys home from Mexico, where the large, plump bird had been domesticated centuries before. Fed mostly on wild nuts, tasty turkeys found their way onto menus all over Europe. When the English colonized North America's Atlantic coast, they brought domesticated turkeys back to the New World, where they originated. The name turkey may be connected to early shipping routes when the birds were delivered to European markets through the country of Turkey. Another theory is that turkeys reminded Europeans of the similar-shaped guinea fowl, which were shipped from Africa through Turkey. Wild and domestic turkeys make appearances throughout our history and folklore, starting with that famous meal at the Plymouth Colony in 1621. Few details are known about that first Thanksgiving dinner in what is now Massachusetts, but we know a little about what meat was served. Native Americans killed 5 deer for the feast, and the colonists shot wildfowl. The birds displayed on the dinner table may have included geese, ducks, and wild turkey, but we don't know that for certain. There's a legend that Benjamin Franklin advocated for the wild turkey over the bald eagle as our national symbol, but there is no evidence to support this turkey tale. However, Franklin was against the bald eagle, stating in a letter penned to his daughter in 1784 that the eagle was a bird of bad moral character, whereas the turkey was a much more respectable bird, a bird of courage. President Abraham Lincoln declared Thanksgiving a national holiday in 1863, and domestic turkeys began to appear on the dinner menu around the same time. Since 1947, the National Turkey Federation, the trade association representing the turkey industry, has presented a live domestic turkey to the president at Thanksgiving. George H.W. Bush gave the first official presidential pardon to the Thanksgiving turkey in 1989. The natural history of the wild turkey in North America, and here on Delmarva, is a conservation success story like no other. By the 1930s, unregulated hunting and loss of habitat had decimated North American wild turkey populations from tens of millions to tens of thousands. The wild turkey had disappeared from much of Delmarva by the late 1800s. Nearly a century later, state wildlife agencies, with the assistance of the National Wild Turkey Federation, began a restoration program that involved trapping wild birds from other states and relocating them to suitable habitat on the peninsula. Since then, our turkey population has continued to increase, and wild turkeys can be found in every county on Delmarva. Today, these large, spectacular birds are a fairly common sight and easy to recognize as they strut along the forested edges of Delmarva's open fields. Wild turkeys are big, plump birds with wide, rounded tails, long legs, and a tiny naked head on a skinny, naked neck. Their feather coloration is mostly dark brown with a bronze-green iridescent glimmer on their plumage. Male turkeys, known as gobblers, weigh on average around 18 to 22 pounds. During breeding season, their heads turn various shades of patriotic red, white, and blue. Adult males have sharp, bony spurs on the back of their legs. They also have a rough, black beard that sticks out up to 12 inches from their breast. Female turkeys, called hens, are about half the size of the males, with less colorful feather and head colors. Hens do not have spurs and usually do not have beards. You can also determine a turkey's gender from its droppings. A gobbler's poop will be shaped like the letter J, and a hen's will appear more spiral-shaped. This is Jim Rapp, and you're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. We're talking about wild turkeys. Turkeys travel in large flocks and scratch the ground for acorns, seeds, berries, insects, and other invertebrates. You can often find their scrapes in the leaf litter in Delmarva's forests. They also swallow grit and small stones to help them digest their food. In early spring, males gather in open clearings to strut, puff up their feathers, flare their tails, and gobble exuberantly. This courtship ritual is meant to impress the gathered females, who often appear indifferent to the male's vanity display. Males breed with multiple females and form all-male flocks after the spring breeding season. Females nest on the ground in dead leaves at the bottom of trees or under thick brush and shrubs. Newly hatched chicks follow the female, who will feed them until they're able to find their own food. Giant flocks, including several females and their young, can grow to more than 200 individuals. Wild turkeys move around mostly by walking, but they can also run and fly when threatened. Turkeys see in color and have excellent vision and hearing. They are adept at sensing predators and can fly short distances up to 60 miles per hour to escape danger. Turkeys can also swim by tucking their wings in close, spreading their tails, and kicking. At dusk, turkeys fly into the lower limbs of large trees and hop upward from limb to limb to roost high above the dangerous forest floor. They usually roost in flocks for safety. An important game bird for Delmarva, wild turkeys provide recreation and enjoyment for hunters and bird watchers alike. Due to their keen senses, wild turkeys are known as one of the most difficult animals to hunt. When they're on alert and scanning their surroundings, wild turkeys can spot something as slight as a blinking human eye from 60 yards away. In addition to perfecting their disappearing techniques with camouflage clothing, hunting blinds, and face paint, many hunters practice the use of muscle memory to minimize their movements. The more a hunter can learn to perform by muscle memory, the less movement of the body, head, and eyes, and the lessened risk of spooking an observant and jumpy wild turkey. Now that your brain is stuffed with more wild turkey information than you cared to know, you can stuff your face next Thursday over a delicious domestic turkey at your holiday feast. Happy Thanksgiving, Delmarva!
Thanks, Jim. Indeed, happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.